Timbuktu became the most tangible example of their efforts to realize this heaven on earth. Now, Timbuktu also helped to make these four men revolutionaries who sought to vanquish slavery through violence. Another unifying theme that brings them together is that they all embraced violence as a means toward vanquishing slavery and preparing the way for this new world. In fact, their new age would be preceded with this kind of apocalyptic violence, and they were unabashed in their ability to use violence. And it's important that Timbuktu was in this wilderness in practice, in a practical level. It was one of the reasons why Timbuktu failed, because of the harsh climate. But from the perspective of an idea, Timbuktu was in the wilderness, and the wilderness for all four men was an important source of individual and of national regeneration. And so in this, they participate in a widespread romantic belief in America, in which Americans of all stripes saw the wilderness as having a powerful, potent, regenerative possibilities. The wilderness was the source for perfecting both the self and the nation. And in the wilderness, it was believed, and these four men certainly believed, that one could commune with God by embracing the God of nature and nature's God. Listen to some of their language. James McKeown Smith, in a letter to Gerrit Smith after he received the plot from Gerrit Smith, visited the region and says, "I felt myself a lord indeed beneath the lofty spruce and maple and birch which your deed made mine." He told Gerrit Smith, I felt myself the Lord indeed. God is within me, and the wilderness is facilitating this communing with God. Listen to Gerrit Smith in a letter to James McKeown Smith, the kind of response to it. Gerrit Smith says, "On these tracks, the settlers will begin a new life, a regeneration. They will brave the rigors of the wilderness and make for themselves a hardy and honorable character." Now, Gerrit Smith initially regarded his gift in unfavorable light because he recognized that it was in the colder and less fertile parts of the state. But he became so kind of drunk to the idea of the wilderness as a source of regeneration that he became reconciled to what he had at first thought was so great a disadvantage. He says, "The chances are 10-1 that the settlers will work out far better character than they would were they to choose their homes on fat lands under genial suns." So the wilderness, this frontier wilderness, not that farmlands, was the place for both the individuals and the nation to be reborn and regenerated. Listen to Frederick Douglass in his newspaper championing the idea of Timbuktu. Frederick Douglass said, "The sharp axe of the sable-armed pioneer should be at once uplifted over the soil of Franklin and Essex counties, and the noise of the falling trees proclaim the glorious dawn of civilization throughout their borders." I mean, this was a place where this dawn of civilization occurred. I mean, it is in their language, and these are just four little snippets. John Brown, when he moved there, said, and this is one of many quotes in which John Brown relates the notion of the wilderness to God and regeneration. John Brown says, "Everything you see reminds one of omnipotence," he said, "of the region, of the ability to achieve this power and to regenerate oneself." So that regenerating themselves from the wilderness was a crucial idea, but ultimately violence became the source of that regeneration, not the wilderness itself. It was violence that became the source for seeking to regenerate themselves and the country. It was at Timbuktu that John Brown planned and carried out his scheme to invade to invade the South and liberate the slaves. It started out as what John Brown called a subterranean passway, which is a kind of militant alternative to the Underground Railroad. And it became the basis of his scheme that culminated in Harper's Ferry. The subterranean passway was literally a network, or not literally, but in Brown's vision, it would be a network of our men located along the Alleghenies, extending up into the Adirondacks. And they were little stations whereby his armed men would help move slaves north to freedom and into Canada. And it was also a site of guerrilla warfare in which he would make attacks on slave property. And Harper's Ferry ultimately became the site where Brown invades in an effort to take over the federal arsenal there and distribute arms to the slaves throughout the South. But it begins with the subterranean passway, and he really plans and carries out that scheme once he reaches, or once he settles at Timbuktu. In fact, Brown was so enthralled with the region that while he moved his family there in 1849, he was away for much of the period between 1849 and his death in 1859, but considered it his permanent home for the rest of his life. And in fact, John Brown was so enthralled with the area that in 1857 he brought back from Canton, Connecticut, a tombstone of his grandfather, who had been a Revolutionary War a hero who had died in the Revolutionary War, and he placed his tombstone at his farm in North Elba. And his son Frederick had recently died seeking to make Kansas free from slavery. And so he inscribed an epitaph for Frederick. And so from 1857 until 1859, the tombstone at Brown's farm became almost a daily reminder of the very meaning behind Brown's name, and that was that the Browns were willing to sacrifice their lives for the cause of freedom. And in the late 1859, or early 1860, three more names would be added to that tombstone. In the short run, the embrace of violence helped these four men bridge racial barriers and forge their extraordinary alliance. They were all four closely connected with Harper's Ferry. Gerrit Smith became the lead conspirator in John Brown's raid over Harper's Ferry. Frederick Douglass spent 2 days with John Brown debating on whether or not he would be John Brown's right-hand man and going to Harper's Ferry. And the main reason Brown decided not to join Brown in the actual raid itself is because he felt it would fail. And Douglass understood his importance to the cause as a speaker and as a newspaper man. And Douglass never once criticized what Brown sought to do. McCune Smith also was quite familiar with the raid. And in fact, in a newspaper, a New York City newspaper before, 3 months before the raid, anticipated a glorious result of Brown's raid by suggesting that if the country did not immediately emancipate their slaves, there would be a full-scale slave insurrection throughout the South caused by an incursion into the South in which a group would distribute arms to the slaves and help them to achieve their freedom. He was prophesying what he hoped would happen as a result of Brown's raid. They were all four intimately connected with it. By 1855, all four men became founding members of a new political party called the Radical Abolition Party. Its inaugural convention was at Syracuse, which was itself a city that was a site of a profound abolitionism and abolition advocates. The Radical Abolition Party, in its platform, articulated a number of factors that they saw that would define their meaning of America. One was suffrage for all men and women, regardless of skin color, sex, or character. Two, they embraced land redistribution in the same way that Gerrit Smith embraced a kind of land redistribution and giving away his land to the black settlers. The part in the very platform of the party itself, it said that no one would be poor and no one would be rich, that everyone would have the same amount of land, and they and the party itself stipulated that the right to own land was as sacred and precious as the right to breathe the air. Violence was very much a part of the platform. The very platform of this party advocated violence against slavery and the slave power in a way to not only end slavery but preserve the peace. These four men believed that slavery represented a state of war. They saw themselves as peacemakers, even though Brown in particular was very violent in his actions. But in his vision, this was a brutal environment, and one needed to be brutal in order to vanquish the war and thus preserve the peace. Also at the Radical Abolition Convention, they also embraced or relied rather on what they referred to as Pentecostal visitations, meaning messages from God to give them direction and guidance in transforming their world, so that their political rhetoric about the meaning of America was also a spiritual rhetoric, that God's government and civil government for them were ultimately one and the same. James McCune Smith chaired the convention at Syracuse, and in the next time that a black man would chair a national political convention would be in 1989, when Ron Brown chaired the DNC. That gives you some sense of how far ahead of their time these men were. And the Radical Abolition Party is, I would argue, a kind of natural successor to what Timbuktu as a settlement represented or signified, this ability to transform America into an interracial country. So that in thinking about the ways in which Timbuktu was successful and significant, I think you could say that it was one of the great accomplishments in the 19th century. Because first of all, you have to understand that the very ability to imagine America as a multiracial country that was also democratic and free and equal, it was itself an extraordinary accomplishment. These four men went beyond what everyone, but what all of their peers in seeking to realize that vision. People like Walt Whitman, for example. Walt Whitman self-publishes his first edition of Leaves of Grass 1 week after the Radical Abolition Convention of Syracuse in 1859, and Whitman poetically articulates this sacred and egalitarian vision of America, but makes no effort to seek to realize it. Emerson makes no effort to seek to realize his understanding of self-reliance. Even William Lloyd Garrison, in his notion of disunion, which James McCune Smith and Garrett Smith called the phantom of disunion, would separate out the righteous from the sinful parts of their society, and did not conceive of all of America in the kind of multiracial way that these four men and the radical abolitionists and the settlers of Timbuktu in general were able to do. And so in establishing Timbuktu, they've sought to make their dream of America, their dream of an American heaven on earth, a reality. And this alone, they really stood apart from their peers. In many respects, I think that the best two-sentence summary of the meaning behind Timbuktu is from Russell Banks's great novel, Cloud Splitter, in which he says, John Brown's hope was to build a true American city on a hill that would give the lie to every skeptic in the land. There were many such utopian schemes and projects afoot in those years, 100 cities on 100 little hills, but Timbuktu may have been the only one that aimed at setting an example of racial harmony. This would be our errand into the wilderness, he said. And that's wonderful language, particularly the idea of a city on a hill and of the power of the wilderness. The notion of a city on a hill dates back to the origins of European settlement. John Winthrop, the great Puritan lawyer who was the leader of the Massachusetts Bay Colony, he and a group of other Puritans, while they were on their way to America, they hadn't even set foot in America yet, were still on their ship, the Arabella, in 1629. Winthrop gives a sermon in which he describes what he sees as the Puritan mission in America, and he says, "We must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us," he continued. And so for Winthrop, this city on a hill was this sacred settlement, this beacon of righteousness that would inspire the rest of the nation and ultimately the rest of the world to follow suit. Yet it's important to understand that Winthrop had no concept of the notion of equality or of freedom or of democracy, really, particularly as it related to various social groups ethnic groups and racial groups. And in fact, the very idea of equality and of freedom and of democracy, the very idea that slavery was a sin, were very, very new concepts. They really didn't come into being until, or didn't flower really until the age of revolution. And so by understanding the significance of Timbuktu within this backdrop, it makes it all the more significant. Banks also uses the language of utopian communities, which I think is very apt because there were many other utopian communities of the day, Foyeristic communities, the Oneida community, the Mormons represented a utopian community, even William Lloyd Garrison's American Anti-Slavery Society and his notion of disunion, of separating the righteous from the unrighteous part of America can be seen as a larger utopian community. But none of these other utopian communities envision their utopia as America itself. They evaded efforts to create through their utopian community also in America. Frederick Douglass and John Brown and Garrett Smith and James McCune Smith define America itself as their utopian community and as their city on a hill and as their new world. Now, what were the limits of Timbuktu and more generally of the vision of these four men? Well, in terms of Timbuktu, one of the profound limits was the very fact that the land itself was extremely poor. As you know, in the winter, it's not exactly what you would call prime or fat lands for farming. These four individuals, and more broadly, everyone who embraced the idea of Timbuktu also embraced the conservative notion of the frontier as a safety valve against oppression and degradation in the cities. Most Americans believed that the frontier was a place to start new and to regenerate oneself, but you needed money to get there. And remember that these 3,000 black settlers who received deeds were extremely poor, who were facing daily oppression from whites. And they really needed about $100 in startup costs just to acquire the oxen and the tools and the staples to get to Timbuktu to try to start the community and survive. $100 for a poor New York City working man constituted about a third of his annual wages. Just to be able to say, you know, to work to save $100 required years and years and years of diligent labor and very, very frugal saving. From Garrett Smith's point of view, he simply did not have an extra $300,000 in cash so that he could give each of the 3,000 settlers $100 to help them get settled. That was a profound limit of Timbuktu. Also, Garrett's gift was maligned throughout the mainstream press. As I suggested, most whites felt that blacks could not become independent, they could not work on their own, they could not receive the fruits of their own labor. Most mainstream whites thought Garrett Smith was crazy by giving away this land. And many of them said that it was worthless anyway and tried to swindle blacks out of their land by trading it, by buying it from them for a song or swindling it in other ways. And so many of the recipients of Garrett's deed ended up for one reason or another, giving it away or selling it away because of whites who tried to swindle them out of it. Moreover, once a number of blacks moved there, they were swindled out of their land by pilots or guides who were whites who sought to point them to land that was inferior in quality and didn't want them there in the first place. There was also a limit in the conception of Timbuktu and in these four men's broader conception of America in their inability to, in practice, advocate full equality for Indians as well as blacks, for women as well as men. As I mentioned earlier, these 3,000 deeds were assigned to men, not women. Now, I explained Garrett's reasons for it, and in theory, and certainly in their rhetoric, all four men did embrace full women's rights, and in their rhetoric, all four men did see Indians as part of American society. But compared with their efforts to end slavery and racial oppression, they spent comparatively little time and energy in seeking to address the horrible wrongs committed with Indians and women. That was another limit. Probably the most profound kind of limit ultimately in what Timbuktu came to symbolize was in the use of violence. While it brought the four men together in the short run, in the long run it destroyed this very alliance and friendship that they had so courageously created. John Brown, of course, dies in the wake of Harper's Ferry. Frederick Douglass has to flee to save his life for a number of months. Garrett Smith has a complete mental breakdown. Garrett Smith believed himself to be culpable for all the for all of the deaths that had been caused in Harper's Ferry. And Garrett Smith was the most ambiguous about his embrace of violence and came to feel that violence as a means to ending slavery was wrong, was horribly wrong. As soon as Brown was captured, he started blue. He couldn't sleep. He couldn't eat. His wife and family thought he was going to commit suicide, and they took him to the New York State Asylum for the Insane. He was there treated by John Gray, one of the foremost 19th century psychiatrists, who gave him a mixture of marijuana and alcohol and then added morphine to it, and Garrett Smith recovered in one sense and went back home within a few months, but for the rest of his life denied his culpability, denied his participation in Harper's Ferry, and distanced himself from his previous radical position in two important ways. For the rest of his life, Garrett Smith believed that one reason for his transgression to violence was his prophecy, was his ability to see God as an important actor in the affairs of the world. For the rest of his life, he no longer saw God as entering the affairs of the world, refused to endorse the idea of prophecy or of millennialism, and came very close to being a thoroughgoing materialist. Virtually abandoned his profound religious faith. The second and more important reason on which he blamed what he considered to be his transgression to violence is that in the wake of Harper's Ferry, Garrett Smith distances himself from Frederick Douglass, from James McCune Smith, and from other blacks, and ultimately concludes that to identify with blacks as he had done, to befriend them as he had done, live among them or try to as he had done, was to court the dark sources of his own nature and to associate with the wrong crowd, and for the rest of his life distance himself profoundly from blacks. It was only after Harper's Ferry that Garrett Smith for the first time begins to embrace or articulate the widespread racist belief in black inferiority and in segregation. And so ultimately, Garrett Smith's backsliding reflects the power of the broader culture that imposes its weight upon radical reformers. And so that in the long run, Garrett Smith, James McCune Smith, Frederick Douglass, and Brown's through a relationship or alliance of friendship gets torn apart in a similar fashion by the Civil War, particularly by the end of the Civil War, little was left of Timbuktu. And in one sense, it was as though Brown's raid, and then in a much larger fashion, the Civil War, represented for these men a kind of apocalypse that was going to prepare the way for the New Age. And the apocalypse had come, but the New Age was nowhere in sight. And it created this profound crisis in which they could never again achieve the kind of radical that they had once been able to do. Thank you.